Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Thanks for joining us here on The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. It's Thursday, June 5th. Today we take a closer look at a mass casualty event that happened on the freeway during the early morning commute yesterday. It was the first time the city's bus ambulance was called into action for a traffic collision. We get the latest on plans to replace the aging Oahu Community Correctional Center. And we take a closer look at the outcome of the presidential election in South Korea with a journalist who had a front row seat this week. Plus, we learn about a voyage of a canoe in Maui Nui, and it's not the Hokulea. This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. For the second time in 6 months, Honolulu's ambulances responded to a mass casualty event. If you recall, an explosion of illegal fireworks killed 6 people and injured dozens of others on New Year's Eve here on Oahu. So many critically ill patients tested our first responders. A collision early yesterday morning involving a city bus and a truck once again challenged the city's emergency medical services department, though thankfully no one died. We caught up with Dr. Jim Ireland yesterday afternoon as he recounted the response, which sent 20 people to the hospital. It was the very first time the city's new ambulance bus had been dispatched to a crash.
Not an unusual call. You know, at 5:30 in the morning, you think it's probably commuters coming to work. You know, not a lot of drunk driving at 5:30 in the morning. Not a lot of, you know, speed racing or anything. So just, you know, normal folks coming to work. I mean, that's what comes to my mind when I hear radio calls like that. But whenever you hear bus involved, whether it's a tour bus or a city bus or even more so a school bus, you know there's going to be a lot of people on it. But at the same time, they're big. So generally, their people are protected. You know, and just if I'm thinking back of past incidents, and, you know, we have an incident involving a bus probably once a month. So, you know, I was up that early and I was listening to this and thinking, okay, this could be something, but it also could be, you know, very benign with no injuries. So out of an abundance of caution, our dispatchers, who are just outstanding, sent a supervisor as well as 2 ambulances. And once the initial crews got on scene, they realized that we did actually have quite a few injured, about 20, they felt. That's what the early report was, and that was actually pretty accurate. The driver of the car was hurt seriously. The bus driver was hurt seriously. And then there were about 18 or so people on the bus that were hurt that ranged from serious to just to minor injuries. Initially, they thought a few people were critical, but then further assessment, they determined there weren't any critical patients and nobody who was deceased. So as much as we hate to see any of these incidents, there was a little bit of relief that it wasn't so bad, certainly not as bad as the New Year's Eve event where we had 20 or 21 patients and nearly all of them were critical.
So fortunately, not as many serious casualties like we had with the fireworks event.
We, I think, triaged 12 as serious and 8 as minor for this event. But we got our first of, I think, about 5 ambulances from EMS, about 3 ambulances from AMR. And we also had our ambulance bus go, which can hold 18 patients. That's the first time it's been deployed to an accident scene, and we've had that bus maybe 6 months now. So put it to work right away. We were able to get people off the side of the freeway into the ambulance bus for further assessment, triage, and then Jared Tenoy, our district chief for the area, was running the operation. He decided, you know, who was going to go to what hospital, and obviously the most serious go to the trauma centers, level 1 trauma center near as Queens, level 3 trauma centers, Polymomi. Got the most serious patients to those ERs, and then a lot of the people with minor injuries went to, I believe, like a community hospital or hospitals. So we didn't overwhelm the trauma centers with, you know, 15 or 20 patients. So hospitals did great. You know, we had HPD and HFD on the scene helping. Freeway Service Patrol was great, you know, blocking the lanes to protect the first responders and patients from, you know, other cars hitting them. So it was really just like New Year's Eve, a team effort, went really well. We never want to see these happen, but everybody performed, you know, flawlessly. And I was very proud of EMS. They did great.
Well, talk about the logistics, because, you know, this is like the morning commute time. And then, you know, how do you figure out, you know, where are the best ambulances to tap?
Yeah, so once we kind of got everybody there, one of the things our dispatch does is they what's called poll the ERs. They call every single ER and they say, how many can you take? How many patients can you take that are critical, serious, or minor? And the ERs give that report, all of them on Oahu. And that's on a little clipboard right in front of our incident commander at the scene. And then as he's getting patients triaged, you know, he'll make a check. Okay, hypothetically, let's say Queens said they could take 15. I don't remember what it was. He said, okay, I'm going to send 5 to Queens. They said they can take 15. Polymomy said they could take 8. And I'm making these numbers up because I don't remember. But Polymomy can take 8. Well, let's send them 4. Kaiser can take, you know, X whatever. Let's send some there. And so they have that report live, instantaneous from the hospitals, what they can take. And the hope is we're not going to have to send them more than they say they can take. But all the hospitals were very generous with their bed space and their staff. Not sure if they had to call extra people in, but they accommodated all the patients very quickly. And so we didn't have any, you know, obviously any pushback or any trouble getting people to hospitals. And then it's just a matter of telling the ambulances, okay, year two, they're serious traumas. They need to go to this trauma center. Year two, they're serious trauma center. You know, they go this way. And so it's really just that triage and directing the ambulances from the scene, from the incident commander to where they're going. We trained for this. New Year's Eve, unfortunately, was our last mass casualty incident, which was so unique because everybody was critical. And this one was definitely scaled back from that in the acuity of injuries, but the patient number was about the same, 20.
Well, you know, I'm just in my mind visually, you know, trying to wrap my head around, you know, dispatching that many of your EMTs. I mean, did you have to call in anybody, you know, off a shift or get people to start earlier?
You know, what's really fortuitous is at 5:30 in the morning is, you know, from about 2 in the morning to maybe 5:30 in the morning is the slowest time of our day. So there's not a lot of calls going on. Fortunately, you know, we had a few ambulances out, but not really. So number one, we had a lot of units available. Number two, the ambulance bus came right away. They had somebody had come in early. They were able to grab it and come. And then most of our administrators who came to the scene, our assistant chiefs, they were kind of up getting ready for work, and they actually responded with vehicles from home. But we had a large workforce there very quickly. AMR had 6 or 7 people there, I think, with 3 or 4 ambulances. So plenty of help. And then the other thing that happens, and this is just the nature of EMS and just wanting to help, is we had other ambulances that had maybe just dropped somebody off at a hospital somewhere in town, and they would get back to dispatch and say, hey, this is Baker 1 or this is, you know, whatever ambulance it was. We're done with our last call. We're available if you need us. And then in some of those cases, the dispatchers would say, yeah, you know, respond to the freeway. We need your help out there. So plenty of help. People got really good care. But there were a lot of injured people. And one thing about a bus accident is they are big, but if the velocity is enough or the energy is enough, generally people aren't restrained on a bus. So they can leave their seats and fly through the air. And I did see a lot of people with kind of bloody noses and kind of contusions on their face or, you know, some lacerations. So I do think at least some of the people on the bus were kind of tossed about, if you will. Again, and that's, I think, how they were injured. Not critically, but still busted up, so to speak. So they were hurt, and I'm really glad we were just able to get them care.
Well, I don't know if you've had a debrief with your team on just how folks responded.
We did. So they all got together at 8:30 this morning. This happened at 5:30. They called everybody together at 8:30. It's called a hot wash. We like to do it right away. I had to go to city council to defend our budget, so I was unable to meet with them on that, but the team already did that. And right before you and I talked, I was kind of getting the cliff notes from that meeting and just how everybody thought that it went very, very well. A few things, you know, little things that maybe we would do differently next time. But for the most part, it went very, very well.
And I'm just thinking, didn't you lose a commission of 1 or 2 of your ambulances recently? I think because of a fire or something.
We did have an older ambulance that caught fire out of service. But also, we just received, I believe, 14 new ambulances, 6 brand new and 8 remounts. So the fleet is healthy. We just got the 14. We're getting 4 more in 3 months. So actually within a year, our entire fleet, every single ambulance that's frontline, will be less than a year old.
Well, that's terrific.
My job is to take care of the people who take care of everybody who calls 911. And part of that is making sure they have the best equipment, the newest ambulances, the best pay we can get them, and just really take the stresses off them so they can just do the job that's so, so important.
Yes. Well, Dr. Ireland, thank you so much for your time, and thank you for all that your staff does.
We really appreciate them, and I appreciate always talking to you.
Thanks again. That was Dr. Jim Ireland, director of the Honolulu Emergency Medical Services Department for the city. He talked with us yesterday afternoon following a mass casualty response on the freeway, which happened at 5:30 yesterday morning. It was the first time EMS used the ambulance bus, which was able to transport many victims to the hospital.
Human rights NGOs have found widespread evidence of abuse of migrants in programs funded by the EU, and they say the European Commission already knows about it.
The Commission is kind of closing their eyes. I would simply call it as a denial.
That story and the day's top global news next time on The World.
Beginning this afternoon at 1.
Hey, it's Michael Barbaro, host of The Daily. The extraordinary reach of New York Times journalism brings you the sound and the story. Times reporters unpack more of what you want to know about our nation and our world as it happens. Catch The Daily Monday through Thursday evenings at 6:30 here on HPR One.
You know, for decades, it seems that the fate of the aging jailhouse, the Oahu Community Correctional Center here on Oahu, has been debated. Well, a bill to fund a new facility is a signature away from becoming a reality. Here at The Latest is HPR's reporter, government reporter, Ashley Mizuo. Good morning.
Good morning. Yeah, so in the budget this year, there is a $30 million allocation for planning of the OCCC. And that's kind of what's being debated right now between advocates and the governor, who is going to have to decide whether or not he wants to line item veto this allocation or let it go through. One thing he told me yesterday is that the Honolulu Federal Detention Center is actually back on the table, possibly to replace the deteriorating, overpopulated OCCC. He said that he asked the president's administration to consider allowing the state to acquire that underutilized federal prison. And he says that they're really only using about 200 out of the 900 capacity there currently.
I made an early overture to the deputy chief of staff just with what our proposal would look like. What we would love to do is to acquire it for a nominal fee, but then take over all of the costs and carry the costs for those 200 beds that they would continue to need. It's kind of a win-win in that case. We noticed that the president's administration was letting some others acquire different properties, you know, across the country, and we thought this was a good opportunity because I know that the people of Hawaii are a little reticent about spending a lot of money on new prisons. I share their feelings, but some of our facilities are so run down, we have no choice. This would help us kind of go over that hurdle.
And, you know, this comes, as I said, when we're waiting Josh Green's signature on that $300 million allocation for DCR to replace OCCC. And, you know, this $30 million is in addition to already $25 million that the legislature has already appropriated over the last decade to the department for new jail planning. DCR says it's spent about $12 million so far. Overall, it's estimated that the actual cost to build a whole new jail is about $1 billion. And as I said, this is not counting the already appropriated money that has gone to the planning phases. The preferred location right now is the animal quarantine station in Halawa. Currently, OCCC has a designed capacity of about 600 beds, but an operational capacity about 950, although as the actual population of the jail is 1,300 people.
Oh, they're so overcrowded.
Overcrowded, exactly. And, you know, the new jail would further increase the capacity by another 350. And that's because, you know, DCR says they do need to address the overcrowding that's currently happening at OCCC. But the Reimagining Public Safety Coalition, which is a group of Hawaii organizations working to reform the correctional system, says that building a bigger jail is not the answer and that the state should instead focus on diversion and bail reform. And that's why they delivered a petition of over 1,000 signatures to Governor yesterday, you know, urging him to line item veto that $30 million allocation and put a pause on the development of a new jail. Here's one of the leaders, Liam Chin.
Diversion to housing and services will significantly reduce the jail population and recidivism, not to mention save millions in taxpayer dollars. Unfortunately, this robust mandate is falling far short due to severe underfunding of diversion infrastructure in Hawaii. We often hear judges and law enforcement ask the question, divert to where? There's nowhere to take people. Instead of an unnecessary new $1 billion jail, the state must prioritize investing in a historic expansion of community-based treatment and supportive housing.
What does this coalition say, though, about the need for a facility?
I don't think that it's really been up for debate about whether or not they need to replace OCCC. It's just a matter of what it's being replaced with. And I think the kind of concern right now with the current plans that have been presented for, you know, building this new jail is that it's significantly going to be larger than the current jail. And, you know, what they're saying is, why do we need a bigger jail if we can invest money now into diversion and bail reform to get people to reduce the jail population? Essentially, so that we don't need to spend $1 billion to build this, you know, bigger, larger jail. The UH Design Center actually did do a kind of like community organizing plan that kind of had different types of more rehabilitative options that would be put in the new jail. However, the Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation is not like beholden to that plan that was made by the UH Design Center, even though they were the ones that kind of commissioned it. And I think that that's been a kind of big concern with advocates of, are they going to follow this, you know, plan that has been set out that has like rehabilitation at the center of it and reentry. And I think there's just kind of a distrust there as well. You know, the coalition has published a report on budget recommendations to policymakers, making supportive housing a top priority. And it's really hard to say how many people in jail in Hawaii are homeless. You know, advocates say it's about 40%, which comes from something that was said by the DCR intake administrator back in 2020. And in the 2023 State of the System report by the Hawaii Correctional Oversight Commission, it says it was about 30%. But DCR pushes back on all of this, saying that it's 7%, although 50% of people do not give an address that are currently in the jail system. Green says he intends to allow the $30 million for the new jail planning to remain in the budget, and that he also wants any new jail facility to be smaller than OCCC. This is not the first time the state has considered acquiring the Federal Detention Center to replace OCCC. You know, back in 2019, the state legislature actually did consider a measure that would have set aside funds to purchase the facility, but it failed. But Green says he has been talking briefly with legislative leadership, and they have been receptive. ACLU Hawaii Carrie Ann Shirota was concerned about the usage of the federal detention centers because of the increased usage of it for immigration enforcement.
Right now, our FDC has increased numbers of people who are suffering there because of the fact that federal government is literally pulling people from their homes and communities and coffee farms and putting them in FDC. And so that sort of plan is a recipe for disaster, that you would be mixing people who are charged from state crimes, convicted of state crime short term, 1 year less, federal detention short term, and then ICE. That is a trauma-inducing recipe.
And I spoke with, you know, Representative Della Abilotti this morning, who does chair the Public Safety Committee in the House. And she also questioned how feasible it would be if the federal government is utilizing the federal detention centers for these immigration detentions. In a written statement, DCR Director Tommy Johnson said that OCCC must be replaced and is working to create a system focused on rehabilitation. He says, you know, support services and programs are available to individuals at the facility to give them an opportunity to change their lives, but that the current design of OCCC doesn't support the space and structure to implement these types of rehabilitative programs and reentry services that they are envisioning for those who are in custody. But the Hawaii Correctional Oversight Commission actually wrote a letter to Governor Green earlier this year that DCR has not addressed issues such as adequate mental health care and a lack of rehabilitation programs from inmates. And that's why they also have called for the pause to the planning of the new jail, because all of these different types of system-wide changes have not been implemented. And so, you know, they offer conditional support for a new jail if DCR does fulfill certain requests and uses the plans that they did commission the UH Design Center to make, listening to the community. But as I said earlier, there's really no mandate for DCR to use those actual plans, which is why so many people are very wary about how the new jail would be built.
And then does Green think that this new federal administration is going to be, I guess, more friendly to his idea?
I think that he is. That's why he says he keeps going to D.C. and these are the types of conversations that he has when he goes there. He's caught a lot of flack from people from taking so many trips there. But he really emphasized in our brief conversation that that's why it's been so important for him to go to D.C.
Yeah. All right. Okay. Well, we'll see what they say. But thanks so much, Ashley.
Thanks.
We've been hearing from HBR's Ashley Mizzou about plans to replace the Oahu Community Correctional Center. Look for a story on HawaiiPublicRadio.org.
Support for HPR comes from Costco Air Conditioning and Refrigeration, featuring Daikin Air Conditioning Systems. Listing of contractors installing Daikin products, that's D-A-I-K-I-N, at CostcoHawaii.com.
The Israeli military seeks to seize 75% of Gaza in a renewed offensive launched last month. Israel also says now only one U.S.-backed group will distribute food aid in Gaza, cutting international aid organizations out. And ongoing uncertainty over whether Benjamin Netanyahu will accept the latest U.S.-proposed ceasefire deal. What's the Israeli government's true goal in Gaza now? That's on the next On Point.
Beginning this afternoon at 2.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Par Hawaii, committed to producing renewable fuels for Hawaii's airlines, electric utilities, and other industries. Learn more at parhawaii.com.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz. Today we're serving up the history of a staple crop in Hawaii that makes its way into many local dishes. It first arrived in the islands aboard the ship Mary in 1847. 2 decades later, the ship Saiotogo brought 149 immigrants and food products made from our mystery plant from Yokohama to Honolulu. By the turn of the 20th century, local manufacturing of a product using this plant started to take off at a small factory at the corner of Punch Bowl Street and Pa'oa Road. Today, around 200,000 pounds of this plant are grown in the islands, specifically in the Kona District. But the supply doesn't come close to matching the demand. Hawaii imports 2.5 million pounds of this particular plant each year. For today's quiz, we want to know the identity of the crop we're talking about. Call 808-941-3689 or toll-free 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. First one to get it right gets a reusable tote bag from HPR.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Nareit Hawaii, which supports nonprofits that are working to provide affordable housing programs to transition renters into homeowners, such as Hawaiian Community Assets. NareitHawaii.com.
You know, just this week, South Korean voters gave the nod to a new president. It was just 6 months ago that the country was gripped in a crisis when its leader, Yoon Suk-yeol, declared martial law, sending shockwaves across the globe. This morning, journalist Jean Lee dropped by our studios to talk about the recent elections. She's the East-West Center's inaugural presidential chair and previously covered Korean politics as AP bureau chief. She started the day yesterday in Seoul, ending the evening in Honolulu.
It was such an eye-opening experience to be in Seoul for this election. And I've been in Seoul for several presidential elections, but this one was really different and I would say important. We saw the footage of the protests for 4 months after that declaration of martial law in early December. Really chaotic scenes. I mean, all throughout the winter, South Koreans were just flooding the streets to protest it against what they saw as a real challenge to their democracy. And then we had that president impeached 2 months ago, and that triggered, or I should say the decision to impeach him was upheld by the nation's top court. And then what we saw was a really fast kind of blitz campaign on the part of people seeking to replace him. So very, very quick presidential campaign. So I was there for the last few weeks of that period. And it was chaotic. You could not go anywhere in Seoul without a rally at every single intersection. So it was full on. So I got to see the last few days of that campaigning. And then I woke up on election day, Tuesday, in South Korea, and it was totally calm. So the last day of the campaigning period, it was rainy, dark, and I woke up on election day and it was bright, sunny, and it did feel like, oh yes, this is a day when you're going to turn a page. They get to finally elect a president after not having one for 6 months. And I should say also it was a vacation. It was a day off for South Koreans. So a good chunk of them had cast their votes early and were out enjoying the day. So it was kind of unusual. It was almost like a vacation day, but you felt the mood that this was a day, the start of a new era. So, yeah, election day itself, I mean, I didn't get any sleep because I think the celebrations or the festivities were going on until 2 a.m. And we did see a pretty decisive decision. The result came out around 6 the next morning. And because there's no transition period because of the snap election, the new president took office immediately at around 7 a.m. So no time to waste. So they are full into this new presidency. And now we're just watching to see how that unfolds.
Yeah. So what can you tell us about him, at this point? And where does he sit compared to his predecessor?
Yeah. So his name is Lee Jae-myung. In Korean, we say Lee Jae-myung, but President Lee, 61 years old, somebody who came from very humble roots. And I think that story has resonated with many South Koreans. Had to leave school when he was very young and go to work, worked in factories, was injured, has injuries, disabilities from that time working in factories, eventually got educated and became a human rights lawyer, transitioned to politics, became mayor of one of the satellite cities in South Korea outside Seoul, governor of Gyeonggi Province, which is the province that surrounds the capital, and then became leader of his party, the Democratic Party. Now, I should say he is a very polarizing and controversial figure as well. He has faced many lawsuits, and those lawsuits, we're waiting to see whether he will continue to be prosecuted or if he's protected because he is now president, but was leader of what was the opposition in the previous era and was a real thorn in the side, I think, of former President Yoon Suk-yeol, the previous president, and his party, So somebody who has been very polarizing as well, because he's very progressive with some of his policies. And now that may be good, I think, and appeals to some South Koreans when it comes to domestic policy, but has been very polarizing when it comes to foreign policy. And so there's a lot of, I think, controversy and question about whether he'll be able to lead the country in a unified way, because he has been in the past very progressive. And there's still a good chunk of South Koreans who are very conservative on a lot of policy. But he has promised to be more moderate, so we'll see.
Well, what can you tell us about the women's vote? Because I was, you know, reading stories about that and the plight of women.
I love South Korea. It's such a dynamic place, and it has changed so much since my childhood. I'm American, but my family is South Korean, so I spent a lot of time there. But I have to say that it's a place that traditionally and culturally is very male-dominated. Now, South Korea, even though being the fourth largest economy in Asia and the 10th or 11th largest economy in the world, still has, among the OECD nations of developed countries, the highest gender pay gap. So women are paid significantly less than their male counterparts in South Korea. And we certainly see, even just watching the images from Election Day, I mean, I saw very few women in the pictures of the leadership. I haven't seen very much from the new president when it comes to women, and I haven't seen many women in his ranks or in his circle. So it's still been very difficult for women to break into those top ranks. Now, the vote, I think, was split both by gender and by generation and by region. And I think, though, that this president did benefit from women who see progressive leaders as being a bit more sensitive to their needs than the conservatives, who might be holding on to the older way of how things have been done. So I think that he did probably benefit from quite a bit of support from women. And yet I think they recognize that this candidate has not, none of the candidates, actually, who are running for president spoke much about women because they did not want to alienate men. Yeah, so let's see. That I think that when I say there's some reservation, I mean, I think there's a huge sense of relief among South Koreans. They finally have a president. They can get moving on things. But there's a lot of reservation about, okay, let's just see. He made some promises. Let's just see how this rolls out and whether the new policies will benefit us. So women supported him. I think that they're also reserving some judgment.
So internally, that may be an issue, but I think globally, folks want to know, how is he going to handle President Trump? How is he going to handle North Korea and China?
Absolutely, absolutely. And, you know, there's the domestic issue, which is the economy. They have extremely slow economic growth. Of course, that's what, in any country, you're just thinking, how can I get by? A big part of that is the trade war or tariff negotiation yes. with the United States, with President Trump. So for this country to have had no president for 6 months also means that you missed that window of opportunity when President Trump came into office. And we've seen South Korea sidelined to a certain degree, because I'm sure in Washington they're thinking, let's just wait to see who we're going to be dealing with. Which kind of government are we dealing with? And so there hadn't been a leader-to-leader meeting or discussion or phone call between South Korea and the U.S. And that is significant because South Korea is a key partner for the United States in the region, as well as being a major economic power now. So one of the first things the new president in South Korea will want to do is get that phone call with President Trump and get those negotiations back on track. So they have started, but no decisions have been made. So he'll want to make sure that that negotiation goes well for South Korea, but also reassures the United States that they're getting things in order and they can be a partner. There's so many issues that will follow from that, right? How is this new president in South Korea going to handle China? He's been very soft on China, or, you know, China is South Korea's biggest trading partner. So it's an important piece of that economic puzzle as well. But how is he going to manage that and the U.S. emphasis on rivalry with China, right? And then, of course, in the interim, the last 6 months, we've seen North Korea deepening its relationship with Russia. And that has consequences in a security framework, because what we're seeing is not only is North Korea sending troops, its yes. own troops to Ukraine, but we believe that North Korea is getting some significant help from Russia in return. And that could be to help its weapons program, probably economically as well. So there's that challenge at a time when North Korea has been very resistant to any interaction with South Korea. So huge challenges economically and in terms of national security.
I'm just curious because you were there in South Korea around the time that North Korea was very embarrassed about what happened to their big warship.
The warship.
Yikes.
Yes. And I have to tell you that one of the things I did was I did spend some time. There's a library in South Korea where you can go and look at North Korean materials, which is illegal in South Korea unless you have permission. So with permission, I went to look at their newspapers. And this warship was just plastered all over their newspapers when they first launched it, before it capsized. And so that always tells me how important this destroyer was to Kim Jong-un, the leader of North Korea, to his military strategy, and to his propaganda. And so something like that helps me also understand how embarrassing and how angry he would have been that they had this incident when they launched that second destroyer. So the pictures I was looking at was with the first destroyer when they launched it into the ocean and it capsized. So, oh my gosh. I mean, the North Koreans have named several suspects they say are responsible for what they call a criminal act. Now, I can tell you that in North Korea, anything that embarrasses the leader is a criminal act. And so your heart just sinks because you just know the price that these people are going to pay.
Yeah, the leader of that country lost face.
Yes. So very interesting to see that as well, and to see the materials firsthand, and to see how that propaganda is being promoted to the people. It gives you a good sense for how important that is for the leader of North Korea in his bigger strategy. But it's also important for us to understand that he is going into the maritime realm. He wants his navy to be equipped as well. There's certainly elements of that destroyer that seem to have some Russian help in terms of the military weaponry that he wants to put on that destroyer. And so we also have to look at those pictures with that analysis hat on and try to look at the direction that he is going. So all of those things, it's not just his anger is amazing, but also what his ambitions are very telling. And so that's something that the new president of South Korea will have to contend with as well. What does it mean that they're trying to establish dominance in the waters around Korea?
I know this week we're dealing with tariffs on steel and aluminum.
Yes.
And I don't know, what is there on the landscape that you think would be important to watch?
So I think when it comes to South Korea, I am very curious to see if this new president, what kind of a role he'll play on the global stage. South Korea has the opportunity now to play a bit of a bigger role on the world stage. Now, is he going to decide to go to the Group of Seven meeting of leaders that's taking place this month in Ottawa? Will he attend that? Will he attend the NATO summit coming up as well? Some of these big global events are what I am watching. Of course, South Koreans are probably watching for something a little bit different because they're more concerned about domestic issues. But I am looking at how is this man, who I have not seen on the global stage, how is he going to interact? What kind of rapport will he have with some of the other world leaders? That will give us a sense as well for how comfortable he is in being leader of a country that is playing an ascending role. The previous president, for all his flawed judgments regarding martial law, was very comfortable in that environment. It was interesting to see. So I'll be watching for that as well. So those are the things that I'm looking for, is Group of Seven, NATO. Of course, how is he going to signal to North Korea that he, because this is a government that will be more pro-engagement when it comes to North Korea, and how will he interact with allies who are looking for a little bit more toughness on sanctions when it comes to North Korea? So how is he going to navigate all of that? These are some of the things we'll be watching.
I've been reading reports that says that he's pragmatic, so we'll see.
He says that, and that is a way to appeal to people who have concerns about how extreme his policies have been in the past. He's saying he's pragmatic, and he's trying to appeal to the centrist and the moderates, but let's see. It's hard to square those words with some of his past policy, but I also think that the South Korean people want to give him the opportunity to show that he can do that and he can unify the country and try to heal some of the division that we've seen over the past 6 months.
All right. Well, Jean Lee, thank you so much for getting up early and joining us today.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be back.
That was a conversation we had with journalist Jean Lee this morning. She was in Seoul covering the presidential elections in South Korea this week.
A proposal to cut federal funding to public media has made it to Congress. If passed, these cuts would impact HPR's ability to serve Hawaii and devastate smaller rural stations across the country. Stand up for HPR and public media. Visit hawaiipublicradio.org/protect.
Congress and EPA attempt to rescind California's ability to clean up its unhealthy air.
These are ambitious rules, but that's because California has air districts that don't comply with federal law, the ozone standard, and with another standard for fine particulate matter that's really, really tiny particles.
And they're making people sick. I'm Jenny Doring, and that's next time on Living on Earth from PRX.
Beginning this evening at 7, following The Daily.
Now it's time to harvest the answer to today's backyard quiz. Earlier, we told you about the history of a local staple crop. It was introduced aboard vessels from China and Japan in the 19th century and soon began to be used to manufacture sauces and blended into curd. Innovative work on this plant continued over the following decades, including seed breeding research at the University of Hawaii that has given rise to many of the varieties of this crop grown on the mainland. The islands import more than 10 times the amount of this crop that's locally produced and made into tasty meals for both humans and animals. We asked you to name our mystery plant, which you can find tableside in many restaurants. Just look for the bottle of shoyu. Yes, we were looking for the soybean. Special thanks to the Soy Info Center for its 400-page history of soybeans and soy foods in Hawaii, which inspired this quiz. But we stumped you on this question. No winners today. But do you have an idea for a quiz that you'd like to share? Write to TalkBack at hawaiipublicradio.org. Today, we are tracking the whereabouts of a particular canoe, not the Hukulea, which is headed to Tahiti to mark the 50th anniversary of the voyage, but one closer to home. This morning, HPR's Catherine Kluwit-Pachtel joins us live. Good morning, Catherine.
Good morning.
So I understand this particular canoe was in your neck of the woods.
It was. So, you know, we're really familiar with the Polynesian Voyaging Society and their canoes, Hukulea, Hiki'anilea, which, as you mentioned, are headed across the Pacific. But earlier this week, I saw social media posts about a voyaging canoe stopping on Molokai. And so my kids are on summer vacation. I thought, hey, I'll take a minute to go check it out. And I threw a mic in my bag just in case. It turned out to be interesting. And it turned out to be super interesting. I learned a lot about this voyaging canoe that I didn't previously know about. It's on a month-long voyage right now between Oahu, Molokai, and Maui. And it's called Iosepa. It's a double-hulled voyaging canoe similar to Hokulea. It was built in 2001. It's 57 feet long. Hokulea is a little bit longer at 64 feet. But Iosepa is made of solid wood, and it weighs 9 tons. Hokulea is made of composite materials, and so it's not quite as heavy. And the crew that I was talking with talked about how challenging it can be to steer Iosepa because of its heavy weight. And it has two hoi'uli, or steering blades, instead of just one, which is more common for a lot of the voyaging canoes that we're more familiar with. It took them about 12 hours to sail last week from Oahu to Molokai, and they spent the week on Molokai. and they're actually in Lahaina right now. Just a couple of days ago, they traveled over to Maui. The canoe is owned by Brigham Young University Hawaii, and it's, when it's not sailing, housed and maintained at the Polynesian Cultural Center. EOSEPA's captain is Mark Ellis, and he shared about this month-long voyage that they're on and a little bit about the canoe's history.
For this particular voyage, what we're doing is we're getting EOSEPA back onto the water. Last year was the first time in about 8 years that we sailed. And so last year we went out for FESPAC, the Festival of Pacific Arts and Culture, and we sailed around Oahu just to kind of do a proof in point. It hasn't been out for 8 years. This year, we're now taking it to Molokai, so we're crossing channels. We're here in Kanokakai on Molokai, and then we're going to be heading to Lahaina, Mala. So the creation of EOSEPA in the late 1990s, William Bill Wallace, who's actually from Molokai, he was raised there. He had an inspiration. He was seeing Hokulea. He was seeing the other canoes like Makali'i and how much good they were doing in the community. And he said, I want a canoe just like that to do good things for my community, which was La'ie. And he wanted it to be a floating classroom for the students of Brigham Young University Hawaii campus. And so that was the main inspiration, is that he wanted to have a floating classroom that would perpetuate the ways of our ancestors.
You know, come to think of it, I probably saw that EOSEPA canoe out at Kualoa when they had all the festivities for the Hokulea, and I didn't even know it.
Yeah, there were. I know there were so many canoes there at the time, and like I said, I actually, you know, haven't heard of this one before. So, Mark Ellis has Molokai ties. His mom and her family are from Ho'olehua, and several of the crew members are from Molokai, too. There are 16 crew members that are on this voyage. And they described coming to Molokai as kind of a homecoming for EOSEPA, you know, and its vision of Uncle Bill Wallace and those crew members who, you know, are from Molokai. Here is Molokai boy Raphael Adolfo talking about how it felt to share EOSEPA with his community here.
I went to school at BYU Hawaii back in 2019, and at that time EOSEPA was just dry docked at the Polynesian Cultural Center. I left for a couple of years, served my mission, and got married, and then we moved back so I could finish my education. And they would have work days on Wednesdays and Saturdays, and so I would show up and help them out with whatever needed to be done. And yeah, that's how I got started. And then the more they learn about me and I learn about them, they learned that I used to sail on Mo'okiha, which is Maui sailing canoe, and so they asked more of me sometimes, and yeah, we just keep working on the canoe, and here I am.
Being, you know, from Molokai and being able to bring this to the community, how is that feeling for you?
Yeah, it's a dream come true. So when EOSEPA first came to Molokai back in 2011 or 12, I was paddling canoes. I was here at paddling practice when they came in. And I remember seeing the canoe, and I think it was at that point where it's like, oh, I wanna sail on those canoes. I didn't know the name of the canoe at the time. Yeah, so it was always been a dream of mine. It's kind of been on the back burner for 13 years. But being able to get on board and sail back here, yeah, it's a dream come true. And then on top of that, being able to go to Kualapu'u, where I went to school, and get back teaching them about voyaging and give canoe tours to family members and friends and just all the people in Molokai. It means a lot, and it's really touching to be back here again.
Yeah, that's really nice. A very, you know, feel-good kind of story.
Yeah, so as he mentioned, you know, the crew, while they were here on Molokai, went to Kualapu School, spoke with some classes there, sharing education about voyaging canoes and wayfaring, you know, very similar to what Hokulea's crew does. You know, they're very involved in engaging with the community, educating, sharing the culture and traditions behind voyaging canoes. And, you know, the crew, at each stop that they're doing, they're volunteering in the community. They worked in the Lo'i in Halawa Valley on Molokai. They are giving canoe tours. They did that on Molokai, and then they're also doing that in Lahaina, where they are right now. You know, a lot of community engagement. And, you know, as Captain Mark Ellis said, you know, this is their first real voyage in a number of years. It was you know, at the Polynesian Cultural Center for maintenance and for kind of planning for a number of years. And so this is really them, you know, getting back out there. They're in Lahaina right now. Last night there was a special free performance for the Lahaina community from the Polynesian Cultural Center. And then, you know, again, community engagement, volunteer work, outreach. And then after Maui, they are heading back to Oahu to visit several communities. They are doing similar outreach in those communities.
Well, thank you for highlighting this story. It's been fun to learn about it.
Yeah, and you know, watching those voyaging canoes as they cross the Pacific, lots going on in the voyaging community.
All right, well, thanks so much. We've been talking with HPR's Maui Nui reporter, Catherine Kluwet-Pachtel. You can find her stories online at hawaiipublicradio.org. Well, we're all out of time, but up tomorrow, we plan to honoho some of our favorite interviews with the creators and performers of Oana, the Cirque du Soleil show in Waikiki. We do welcome feedback. Call or talk back line 808-792-8217 or email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Want to listen back to something on our show? Find the conversation on Spotify, Apple, or on our website. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.